It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Hey, everybody. This is Greg Gutfeld. This is The One. I'm very excited to have this young man on my show. His name is Noah Rothman. He's got a great book out called Unjust: Social Justice and the Unmaking of America. This is a topic we always talk about. By the way, Noah is associate editor at Commentary, very talented writer. You have a lot of fans here, a lot of people. Obviously, Dana often brings up, oh, Noah Rothman wrote this, Noah Rothman. I go, why don't you just shut up about Noah Rothman? That's what I say to her.
Don't tell her that. I appreciate this.
Yeah.
She's on the book jacket. She
of
held me quite a bit.
Is.
I owe her many favors.
Oh, what a bunch of log rolling. My goodness. So this is a hard book. Okay. This is a hard book to turn in because it feels like you can keep writing a new chapter, right? Like as you, because you're like, it's not like the story on the kind of like the abuses of the social justice movement just stops when you're done writing the first draft. Do you have to keep going back and adding things?
Yeah. So in the just world, there'll be a paperback edition, right? And then I'll get to add a whole bunch of stuff
yes.
to the forward. I'm not sure that's going to happen. But yeah, I mean, part of the problem was knowing, you know, what to add and where to stop. And what's really a big deal insofar as it is indicative of an ideological movement and an ideological trend, and what's just an anecdote
right.
that you should treat as
exactly.
an anecdote.
Exactly.
So I try to do that as much as I can. And that sort of comes to a little existential quandary at the end of the book, because I go back and forth as to whether this is a trend line that is forcing America into a place that is antithetical to all the ideals of the founders, or some days I feel like it's just a fad.
Well,
it should be treated like a fad.
Kind of when, a story you look into is based on 3 tweets. You know,
right.
and you go, well, it's not a story, but then but because it keeps happening over and over again, you go like, well, maybe it is. But I guess the first thing you should do for our listeners is you don't like the term social justice
warriors.
What?
I don't use the term social justice warriors because it's an offensive slur to people who believe in the ideals of social justice. And
right.
the idea of this book is to reach people who find a lot of these ideas attractive
mm-hmm.
and valuable and, you know, essential to the American experiment, and convince them where it has gone wrong.
What is the difference between social justice and justice?
Well,
great question, huh? Didn't think I'd come up with that one on the fly.
It is a core question. Hayek dealt with this. Essentially, he said that you append the word social.
Salma
anything.
Hayek?
Unfortunately not.
I know.
The less attractive one. You append
how
the word
do you
social,
say his first name? Friedrich? Is it
Friedrich?
Friedrich Hayek?
Friedrich von
yes.
Hayek? You append the word social into anything, it destroys the meaning of the word it modifies.
Right.
So there is no such thing as social justice.
Mm-hmm.
There is only justice.
Mm-hmm.
To create social anything is to distort its meaning. And justice as we understand it, the kind of justice that's meted out in a courtroom, is predicated on the idea of an individual. The individual is responsible for his or her individual actions, not
mm-hmm.
that of individuals around them or their ancestors. And that is not what social justice appeals to. Social justice appeals to a more tribal, collectivist understanding of what constitutes guilt
mm-hmm.
and tries to reshape the justice system around those ideas in a way that is antithetical to English common law, undermines the foundational concepts of justice as we understand it, which is why it's so destructive to the American social experiment.
Mm-hmm. It seems, and maybe it's supposed to seem to me because I'm a white male, that it seems highly punitive. I mean, it seems like but I think that almost anybody can see that it is punitive. Like, there's a punitive aspect to it that must feel good.
Its advocates would call it a punitive experiment
mm-hmm.
designed to convey to you the sort of paradigmatic understanding of where your guilt lies in a much more collectivist sense and a transcendent sense, transcending generations. I mean, it goes – and this is not just necessarily a theoretical, like, thought experiment. The foundational reimagining of what justice is or should be is what underlined the intellectual foundations for the experiment that resulted in the 2011 Dear Colleague letter from
mm-hmm.
the Education Department, which changed the guidelines around Title IX.
Mm-hmm.
The theorists around this felt that justice was too narrowly construed when it comes to things like sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
And concepts like forcing your accuser to confront the accused in a courtroom and evidentiary standards consistent with a violent crime, all that stuff was too traumatic for a victim,
right.
too excessive, and didn't really conceptualize conceptualize what justice should be from a feminist perspective. So they got rid of all of that. Mm-hmm. And in the process, they deprived accusers and accused of likes of their First, Fifth, and Sixth Amendment rights. Mm-hmm. I mean, no conception of justice as we understand it in this country would call that justice.
Right.
But in the minds of a social justice advocate, it was designed to repair. It was reparative because mm-hmm. it reached back into history and transformed the things that we have been dealing with for so long that are so ingrained in our consciousness, we don't even think about them as injustices.
Right. So what I mean, that has been damaging, I think, to our country. Are there other areas that you believe social justice, let's say the social justice mob, the bad part of the social justice movement, what other areas do you think are damaging? I think about just the rise of mob action online in general. It seems to be something that is coming from this. It's combining Twitter and social justice to me has not been a good thing.
No, absolutely not. I mean, that's a great vehicle for social justice advocates to really get mobilize what you call a mob. And I think it's a apt description for what occurs online. And I would that it was only limited to online. It has been bleeding out into the real world, and it often manifests in street violence, particularly among people who are so ingrained in identitarian philosophies, right and left. This book is mostly about the left, but not mm-hmm. exclusively.
Right.
Unfortunately, there's these tendencies exhibited on the right, a victimhood complex, and a society that
it's contagious,
and a society that gives a kind of credence and value to a commercialized value to victimization, literally to the point where they're actually trying to sell you something. My favorite mm-hmm. anecdote in the book is the story of Fearless Girl. Mm-hmm. Fearless Girl was this statue.
Right.
Right? Erected downtown, lower Manhattan, arms akimbo, high school-age girl standing across from the Wall Street Bull, and it was feted by people on the left, primarily, who you would expect to fet it. You know, Bill de Blasio said it was very offensive towards men. It was very hard to find a man who was offended. He was sure they were. Elizabeth Warren, Gail Collins in the New York Times said it was the most effective protest against patriarchy since the protests in the antebellum New York that desegregated the trolleys.
Amazing.
Turns out this was a commercial, right, for a Wall Street investment firm. So people like Elizabeth Warren, who can't go two breaths without denouncing Wall Street greed, were standing next to this commercial.
Yeah, fantastic.
And we found out why they were doing this. It wasn't long before there was a Department of Labor audit, which found out they were systematically discriminating against their female and African-American employees. They settled to the tune of $5 million for all these employees who were disenfranchised. And that's why they were getting this. They were, you know, offering deference to these woke nostrums in order to get some indulgences from the social justice crowd. And they got them for a pittance.
By the way, every company does this. I know it's an overused phrase, virtue signaling, but it seems like every company's HR or their marketing or their corporate whatever are figuring out ways. Used to be like in the old days, it would be just a charity fun run. Remember?
You know, it was quaint.
Yeah, it was quaint. You know, the 5K for whatever illness.
Right.
Yeah, but it's so different now that you have to.
Illnesses are passe.
Yeah, now
generally.
Diversity, identity, inequalities. If you don't do it, I just wonder though, does it help? If you're targeted by a mob, no matter what you do, you're screwed. I think that is just, what's that Rene Girard stuff? People get caught up in this mob stuff. It just feels good. And this is just a new way of doing it, I guess. It's been around forever.
Right.
But now it's just come back in a different shape.
Yeah, this is Elias Canetti and, the psychology, the mass psychology of crowds and mobs. And, there is a lizard brain that sort of takes over. And the sense of solidarity is so transcendent that it has to be an evolutionary trait, right?
Yes.
And it's so universal that there has to be something here that is a survival mechanism.
Right.
So it's like fighting against the tide. I mean, I'm not going to say that this is an anti-identity politics book because that is commanding the tides to recede.
Right.
It is, however, to demonstrate the excesses of this kind of behavior.
Yeah. It's interesting. From an evolutionary standpoint, the mob protects you because you're part of it.
Right.
And so a lot of people, I think, on social media will join one of these like mobs because maybe it won't happen to them. It's like that famous, it's like the crocodile that eats you last,
right?
Still eats you.
But they're so powerless.
Yeah.
There really is like a 72-hour window to these things. And
but
if you write it out, there's been, for example, companies, Wall Street Journal had a report on this. Studies have demonstrated that the firms that don't cater to this sort of thing do write it out and there are very few financial consequences. But there's also financial value to acquiescing to the mob's demands,
right, yeah.
Especially in a segmented marketplace, because you can generate more commercial activity as a result of that. You, mm-hmm. Even if you alienate a few customers in the process, you alienate, for example, your conservative customers by demonstrating your deference to, you have a Macy's, for example, get rid of these plates, right?
Right.
Show you portion control.
Doing that on the GG show.
And they will, and I guarantee you that there will be now a marketplace around that sort of thing. Just like there were, you know, the Nike got rid of flag shoes when they were never on the market.
Yes.
There was no outrage as a result of this. One person said they were outraged and they announced preemptively that there was a controversy around this thing. And then all of a sudden you have Republicans saying, I'm going to go find flag shoes wherever they're available.
Yeah.
And a marketplace sprung up overnight for flag shoes.
Exactly. It's the rebel marketplace. Did you see the latest story? It reminds me kind of the plate story. Forever 21. When they send out products, they also send out free products for you to try with their clothing. And it was Atkins protein bars or whatever. So I think it was Jezebel. Not sure. Might have been Jezebel wrote about like, oh, they're sending these bars. It's like weight shaming because they're health bars. It's like, actually, no, I think Forever 21 puts these Atkins bars in every box. But now they're probably not. Because, you know, somebody said, my God, somebody who has, you know, issues with their weight, what are you telling them when they bring the, it's like the plate.
Sure.
You know?
And there's some frivolity to this sort of activism.
Yeah.
But it is predicated on a real, valuable, in a way, and also a dominant sort of intellectual movement that's prevalent on the left, but not exclusive to the left. And a real valuable intellectual history. Social justice, as we understand it, the first time we can use the phrase concomitant with its current meaning is mid-19th century Catholic Church. And the Catholic Church was seeking a way to differentiate itself from the secular Protestant Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. Catholics had a very different experience with Enlightenment in the French Revolution, so they were hostile towards it. Created an idea around charity, basically, that they called social justice. It was a Jesuit philosophy. And a few hundred, about 100 years after that, the philosopher John Rawls began to put a little bit more meat on these bones and talked about justice as though we should think of it like it's a finite commodity, that it needs to be doled out and distributed so that you, based on your accidents of birth, have access to as much justice as the next person.
Right.
And the only way to do this is to create perfect institutions with enlightened distributors operating behind what he called a veil of ignorance, so that the distributor doesn't know who the objects of his distribution are going to be, can't satisfy his or her biases, whether they're known or unknown. Mm-hmm. Modern social justice advocates, to the extent they're even aware of John Rawls, reject John Rawls.
Huh.
They have no use for the veil of ignorance because it's morally obtuse.
Yeah.
How can you have a just distribution if you don't know who the objects of your distribution are going to be? Mm-hmm. Who's oppressed? Who deserves to some comeuppance or to be tamped down a bit? I mean, this is the society that they're trying to engineer, which is very arbitrary and very rapacious. It's something that inculcates in the people who believe this sort of thing a sort of vengeful spite, which is psychologically damaging.
Yeah.
In part because American institutions are not designed to do the kind of things that they want them to do.
Yeah.
So you can have a very a reaction to that that's either makes you very depressed or resolved to radicalize.
Yeah, and I think your point about social justice is, well, you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. It's like the politically correct movement. The political correct movement, maybe at the beginning, was good. You know, it was, you know, don't be mean to other people.
Don't be a jerk, right.
Yeah, don't be a jerk. That's kind of where it should have, but it's so far beyond that to a point where almost any behavior can be deemed a microaggression, right? It's like if I say, where are you from? That's a microaggression because you're suggesting that they're not from here or they're that something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, political correctness as we understood it in the 90s is like adorable.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Who started this whole frenzy? How did it go from, I'm assuming it happened on campus, how did it go from something that was so noble into something that's almost a farce?
Yeah, so I think a lot of the radicalism that we see today, particularly on the left, but again, is being more and more adopted by the elements on the right because it's so effective, is due to the philosophy of intersectionality.
I was going to get to that.
Yeah. So this started off as a pretty obscure theory on academic campuses in the late 1980s, early 1990s, formalized by Kimberly Crenshaw Williams. And it postulates essentially, and it's a pretty valuable thinking experiment. postulates essentially that we are all born with disparate traits. Some traits are discriminated against more than others, and discrimination is therefore doled out in degrees. Mm-hmm. So you, as a African-American male, will experience less prejudice in your life than an African-American female.
Right.
Because black women experience more prejudice than men, and therefore, even though you're both African-American, women have the upper hand in the intersectional ladder. So right. on and so forth. The Native American lesbian has it really terrible. Know mm-hmm. what I mean?
Yes.
So from there is a way to understand how the world works. This is, again, a very valuable thought experiment. As a political philosophy and organizing principle, it's seriously deleterious to the actual organization in which you're in. Mm-hmm. And I cite the Women's March as an example. So Women's March, January 2017, arose out of nowhere. It was very sympathetic, totally organic. Mm-hmm. Nobody knew who was behind it, but the philosophers, but rather the organizers behind it, were adherents to this organizational theory of right. intersectionality. And so they did things that ended up destroying their movement. They embraced people with no political constituency.
Right.
People like Joanne Chesimard, who's a cop killer, living a fugitive in Cuba.
Cuba, right.
The Reverend Louis Farrakhan, Minister mm-hmm. Louis Farrakhan, who's an overt anti-Semite. Yeah.
This was Linda Sarsour's contribution.
Tamika Mallory.
Yeah.
And getting, you know, having the Sister Soldier moment with these people would have cost them nothing. Probably would have gained them.
So they
cachet.
Yeah. They, in the Women's March, you couldn't be pro-life. That was like with a group that was not
right.
you. And I'm trying to figure out who else. And there was a scent of anti-Semitism.
It's a brief scandal around the fact that the people around them who were white and Jewish could not be allies in their entirety.
Yeah.
Because they were white and Jewish. They were, in the words of Tamika Mallory, they were advancing white supremacy. Whether they knew it or not, they could believe all the things that they believed. But by virtue of their skin color and their accidents of their birth, they could not be considered total allies. The Democratic Party wrapped their arms around this organization in the beginning days. And they eventually had to divorce themselves from
it.
So when I talk to college students about this, who are 100% behind intersectionality, I think it's a very empowering philosophy. I tell them about this and the extent to which this movement was disempowered as a result of their embrace of this philosophy. They lost political currency because of the ideals they espoused.
You know, and this reminds me of how intersectionality and the belief that one cannot know someone else ends up destroying movements and positive products that would help a movement. Like I'm thinking of the Scarlett Johansson when she was supposed to play, or she was going to play a trans. She's going to play a trans man or a trans woman. I can't remember, but there was the outcry, and she was, I think, producing this film, and there was an outcry among the activists that they should have the trans man play the trans man or the trans. And so she said, "Oh my!" She freaked out. She said, "I'm not allowed." She backed out, and then I'm pretty certain the film never got made. So
victory.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, exactly. It's like they got the scalp, but they lost the battle.
So this is when I start thinking about this movement as sort of a self-destructive passing fad.
Right.
Because and there's a lot on this on chapter 5, which is about the really silly excesses of this movement, where you it's hard to avoid the conclusion that this movement is very focused on itself.
Yes.
And targeting people who already believe what they believe.
It's so true.
Because those are the people who are most likely to genuflect and supplicate in deference to this mob.
But you can never be there's a competitive element to it within it.
Right.
So you have, so it's like between
you
and
me. One up the next guy.
Yeah, it's like outrage. You don't, because we cannot empathize with each other. That's in an intersectional, if you keep drilling down into it, you and I cannot. Yes. And that means one of us has to be more intersectional than you. And so what you're saying, and I cut you off, is that it's an internal kind of combustion. It's going to fold into itself.
There's a lot of performance to it.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, like a sort of a tempered outrage that's really on the level commensurate with whatever the offense for your local food truck has done to you.
Yes.
I mean, like that, the level of offense you should take to that, that's not going to really move the needle.
Yeah.
So you definitely have to outdo the next guy in terms of outrage.
This is such a touchy subject, literally, for a Fox News podcast. Have you been following the waxing controversy?
I am aware of it.
Yeah, maybe I shouldn't even go there because then I will. Yeah, let's just say if you want to read up on the waxing controversy, Google waxing controversy. It's like, trans woman. Okay, man who identifies as a woman but has all the male equipment is demanding that these, like, would you call them cosmeticians?
I suppose so.
I'm not sure what but they're to wax his, to give him a bikini wax, but cosmetologists, I think that's, to give the trans person a waxing, but the women feel that this is not their way. And in fact, they feel that it's almost an assault on them to be forced to do this on male genitalia. So you've got this weird world where it's like, where one part of a political arena is actually kind of forcing something on women.
There seems like there should be an existential intellectual conflict there between the inclusivity of the trans community and forcing a woman to engage in sexual-related assault-like behavior that they're not satisfied by. There's actually a feminist movement, a branch within feminism, that has run afoul of the intersectional left because it is very hostile towards the idea of trans femininity and the intrusion of trans women, men who used to be men and are now women, in traditional female arenas like sports, for example.
Yeah.
And they have a very conflictual relationship with the feminists.
Yeah, I mean, Martina Navratilova has run into that. And you know, she's been outspoken, but then she's very careful about it. But she's talked about that. You know, that brings me to, I want to finish up on this because I know that I get distracted by these. There's so many of these interesting cases. We're talking about, like, we just talked about Martina. The big problem with the social, let's call the social justice movement hysteria, not social justice, and in the intersectionality and the microaggression, the mobbery, people don't want to share the risk. It's like if you see somebody that you know that is getting targeted, you realize that if you go to that person's defense,
You're next.
And so you have to sit there and you go, well, maybe this will only last 72 hours.
It does. It usually does.
Yes, it does.
It usually does.
Yeah.
So that's why, you don't have to feel that quandary, that moral quandary.
I do. I think that you have to, end of the day, a banned phrase, you have to be willing to share the risk, because if you don't, the mob's going to get you anyway.
Right.
And I think the more people that are willing to do that, I was also going to bring up another. Because the weapon in this kind of climate is the smear. You're a racist, you're a sexist, you're a bigot. What I've noticed is maybe it's the lawsuits. It's what happened to Gawker, or what happened, what the Covington kids are doing. What's the bakery next to the school that was, remember they, was it a bakery that had ejected some students for shoplifting, but they said they were racially profiled.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I can't think of the name.
I mean, either.
I can't remember the name of the school. But anyway.
This is all the stuff that goes in the foreword. This happens in the months that – the four months that have elapsed since I published this thing.
Yeah, and so they sued the school. I think it was a bakery or it was a deli, sued the school for millions and won. And I'm beginning to think that we are looking into a correction. I think we're seeing a correction, and the correction is when all of a sudden – there's skin in the game, that if I decide that I'm going to smear you, Noah, the skin is you can sue me. And it's not like an opinion anymore. It's like, no, you've hurt me. Like, I've hurt you, so you can sue me. So the Covington kids, the bakery, I'm looking at, like, and to some extent, I look at Peter Thiel, what Peter Thiel did to Gawker.
Right.
I don't know how you – like, I have mixed feelings because I even wrote for Gawker. But, you know – they became scalp hunters, and I had run-ins with them about it, regarding me, and I'm like, why me? And because I had gone to Fox, obviously. But I think that now that there's some kind of skin in this game, that the scalpers could get targeted.
Well, there's certainly less deference to the social justice mob because they've demonstrated themselves. I mean, the existence of the 72-hour window that we all talk about now is a demonstration of how little actual authority they have on their own that you don't grant them.
Right.
To be tormented by this requires a certain amount of complicity on the part of the tormented.
Mm-hmm.
You can outlast it. Sometimes that seems superficial because it is unnecessary on the part of – you get pressure from employers. You get pressure from social conventions to
bend. Don't want to apologize to them, and that
doesn't usually help.
But what happens if you're working at a company,
all right,
and their company says, "Hey, look, Noah, we need to get this passed. We need to get past this.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be over. We just need you to read this thing, or we want you know to post this, say that you didn't mean it, and you have to make a choice. It's like, a little, I think a part of you dies.
Part right? of you dies, but you keep your job.
You keep your job, but a part of you dies. And, you know, because everybody, I mean, look, the left and the right do this. The left looks for a scalp and they get it. And somebody, when somebody has to apologize,
right.
And something just happened with a comedian. I won't give, it was something about a joke about a dead rapper. Did you follow this?
Yeah, I saw that on, again, Twitter. See, where these, the only reason why I would ever see anything like so that many, is because it came across Twitter.
It's so funny because I was, you know, I'm wrote a book proposal that is kind of, it's like all this, but I'm going like, you know what? It's just like, maybe it's just, there's just, it's so many that I would never ever finish writing this book. It seems like every day there's just like, it's, I wrote a book a while ago called Joy of Hate. And it was like, it came out too early. It was in 2012.
You're ahead of the curve.
I was ahead of the curve. I was ahead of the hate.
Yeah, the biggest, I think, part of the problem with, or the reason why we have a backlash now that is being actually gaining traction is because the right has adopted a lot of these tactics.
Yeah, now people don't like it.
Well, they've discovered, yeah, that this actually does cut both ways.
Yeah.
And in part because, and I say this in the book to the chagrin of a lot of my conservative readers, but I do think the president played a big part. Mm-hmm. In normalizing the kind of behavior that is very similar to the social justice left, adding currency to a victimization narrative, creating the belief and instilling the belief in a set of the electorate that your actions were not the response, your lot was not the result of your actions, that people in positions of power, unseen authorities that put obstacles before you were exploiting you, and this was a system of justice that was mm-hmm. not just. And needed to be dismantled. Mm-hmm. You heard that in the notion that it was all, you know, the unofficial slogan of the Trumpian right in 2015 was burn it all down. You saw that on Twitter all the time.
I think, you know, I agree.
You see that now in people like Cory Booker, mm-hmm. who say that the system needs to be dismantled.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he just said that the other day.
That is burn it all down.
Yeah. But, you know, the other thing, though, but see, Trump was such a Democrat. He was a Democrat then. He was a Republican. I think it was just outsiderism. Like I kind of missed. I think I missed the boat. By the way, I'm editing everything you just said out of this podcast. but I do. I mean, I think I think to your point, the victimhood thing was because they felt that they had been told they were bad for so long that they like. I'm tired of being told that I'm the reason I'm the reason. Why there's so many problems in this world because of who I am. And I think that was like, and I think Trump was kind of maybe putting that, you know, encapsulates like.
There's a grain of truth to it. There's more than a grain of truth to the notion that African-Americans, Hispanics in this country, LGBT members have been actually discriminated
yes.
against historically and currently.
Yeah. Yeah.
And as a result, they feel aggrieved and want to pursue that grievance. That's true.
Mm-hmm.
The philosophy that imbues you with a kind of victimization narrative and then results in currency from that victimization, from perceiving yourself to be victimized and creating mm-hmm. rewards for that behavior will be get more behavior. It becomes a marketplace. It's
right.
supply and demand. And now all of a sudden we have this huge demand for victimization, and everybody's shocked that we have a glut of supply.
Yeah, it's true. We'd even get to Smollett. Maybe next time, Noah. Noah, great book. You do great work. I always
you,
enjoy
sir.
Your writing. And follow him on Twitter as well. You are at
Noah C. Rothman.
Yes, and also you can get him at Commentary. And his book is called Unjust: Social Justice and the Unmaking of America. I like how I try not to look down when I'm reading it, as if I'm on TV. It's a freaking podcast, Gutfeld. Also, you have great hair. I didn't notice that. You have very good hair.
Thanks so much.
I'm just, you know, as I get older, I have hair envy. Did I just do a microaggression? My producer's shaking his head. You're not supposed to comment on people's appearance. Yes, you know, I am.
We can go into genetics about it, you know?
yeah, you know
the
what?
The Jewish-Irish genetics that resulted in this coif.
Well, let's get Charles Murray in here. We're going to do a three-way podcast. Okay. Noah, thank you so much. And good, best of luck with the book.
Thank you, sir.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.